Tax season is here, and most employers are required by the IRS to file information returns. An information return is a mandatory form, such as a 1099 NEC or a W-2, that is used to notify the IRS and taxpayers about taxable income. E-File 4Biz makes it easy to file and deliver 1099 and W-2 forms online. Their easy-to-use interface helps you file forms in just minutes. You can enter your data manually or import from Excel, QuickBooks, and Xero. Enter your data and E-File 4Biz processes, prints, mails, and files 1099 and W-2s for you. Easy! Get all-inclusive E-File services quickly, efficiently, and securely with E-File 4Biz today. It is free to try. Only pay when you're ready to file. Visit now, www.efileforbiz.com. That is the letter E, the word file, the number 4, and biz with a Z as in zebra, .com.
Hey there, podcast listener. This is Jeremy from the show. We do want to apologize for some of the audio on this episode. The guest had some machines running in the background in order to keep her business going, which, as an entrepreneur, is an awesome thing. However, it did unfortunately affect some of the audio quality, so we do apologize for that. We are working on a new system, and we are upgrading the audio, which will be up and running in a few weeks. So please stay tuned. It's going to be awesome. And while I have you here, please, if you're interested, we are giving away free sponsorships to the show. Go to mmsponsor.com to apply.
A lot of entrepreneurs that are that, well, yeah, I think I want to go at my own. I want to set my own schedule. I don't want to work, you know, crazy hours. Oh wait, I work crazy hours, but, you know, you know, at least that initial pretty view. And I decided I still needed to be there for my girls. I didn't want somebody else dictating my schedule. I didn't want people telling me whether I could take vacation or not. I wanted to just be able to do it on my own.
So Jeremy, it's just me and you today, brother.
Yeah, I know.
Which means it's gonna be our best episodes ever.
It feels like we're doing the behind the mics, but you know, we're not.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Hey, do you take that guitar off the wall? Are you practicing every so often?
So I have an acoustic that I've been playing on. I'm leaving that guy because that one that I got for free, and it's not bad, but I want to wait. I want to get good on the acoustic, and I'll do the, because when I do the electric, I want to really be able to rock out.
Bring up your, if you're willing, bring up your acoustic for our holiday party here. We're no spouses like we used to do. It's just going to be just colleagues, and we're going to be in that big room upstairs. It's just going to be kind of weird, but
it's going to be like at the quarterly meeting when me and you were playing with the new amp and jamming out, and everybody's just like staring just at each other.
Yeah, everyone walked
just
away.
Leaves, just leaves. That's funny.
Well, let's listen to this interview. I'm super curious what you think. This is Ali Banholzer. She is in my mastermind, which you know is the Edison Collective. We meet 4 times a year, and every year we have some people that stay in the group and we introduce some new folks. And this year we have 3 new people. Well, Allie's been with the group now. This is for her 3rd consecutive year. She runs a business called Wear Your Spirit Warehouse. I call it a promotional company, like promotional items. I like the word she uses. They put decoration on any kind of item. And I thought it was just like a warehouse. It's in their name, Wear Your Spirit Warehouse. It is a manufacturing business. I toured the facility. I spoke with her. And I know her story, and it's a powerful story. So I'm not going to give you any insights into it. Just listen in and we'll discuss. Here we go. So we're live. So the first thing I want to ask you is that noise in the background, what machine is that I hear?
So that is the embroidery machine. We're currently in production. And
I love that you call your ATM. Why do you call it that?
So we joke, whenever it gets quiet in here, I start to get concerned because here... Noise means money. So any of the equipment that's running, but the embroidery machine in particular, when the needle is going up and down, making that hum, we're making money. So we consider that our ATM. We want to hear it running all the time.
I love it. So, and I had the privilege, obviously, you know, but our listeners don't know, of spending time in your facility. You took me and other entrepreneurs for a tour. It's impressive. Yep. I, when I think Thanks. Of a promotional, when I think of a promotional, you're welcome. But when I think of a promotional business, I think of a small warehouse and the printing gets done in China or something. And it's really just managing inventory. You're more of a manufacturer.
I needed something I could do that gave me some adult interaction. And I loved to scrapbook. So I started developing products for the scrapbook industry and just selling those products.
So were you literally making them out of the house or how were you doing that?
I was. It was at my kitchen table to start. And then I kind of took over our basement and it grew. And then in 2007, 2008, with the recession, that industry really tanked. Two things happened. One, it's very much discretionary income. It's a hobby. And so a lot of people no longer had the discretionary income to spend on it. And two, it went digital. And my products were physical. And so, but I had this equipment that I could do signs and banners and printing. And so I kind of reinvented the business at that time and just said, okay, I've got this equipment. What can I do with it? It was an election year. So I started making signs and banners for local candidates and then businesses.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And then let's talk about David now. So your husband, I think one of the most... Well, for me, the most accomplished or credit, I don't even know what it is, Air Force pilot I've ever experienced. I toured your house and I've never seen so much recognition. So just tell me a little bit about David.
So David was a pilot in the Air Force. He served 24 years on active duty. And at the pinnacle of his career, he was the commander of Air Force One. He was the 14th presidential pilot of the United States, appointed by President Obama. And he flew Air Force One for Bush and Obama, but there's one pilot that is always appointed to come in, and they're the numbered pilots. That's always in the left seat. So that's what he did. He was appointed to that position in February 2014.
So he's commander of Air Force One. After we toured your facility, or actually the day before, you also invited us over to your house, and I remember in your dining room there is a shadow box, I don't even know what the term is, but all different, I think it was pieces from different Air Force Ones. Was that true? Like different airplanes?
Yeah, so he was a very loved commander. He was a phenomenal leader, and I've taken so many leadership lessons from just watching and observing him in the shadows, so to say, or as his number two. And his maintenance officer set about, when he left command, his maintenance officer set about to find every airplane that's ever been flown as Air Force One. So Air Force One is actually a call sign. It's not an airplane. Now, what we know are the big blue and white 747 as Air Force One. But anytime the president is on an aircraft, it is the branch of service in one. And it's the air traffic control designation. So that it came about because there was almost a mid-air collision with those numbers of all the airplanes. And obviously, very long. So it came about the call sign, that one. So that's why you have Marine One, which is the helicopters, because the Marines fly it. Marine One, if you were on a Navy jet, it would be Navy One. Obviously, the iconic one is Air Force One.
Yeah.
It turns out at that time, there were about 55 airplanes that had been used as Air Force One, some of them more prominent than others. And his maintenance officer set about to find every airplane, and he called them up. And this guy could sell ice to an Eskimo. He called them up and asked them for a part of the airplane, and they actually sent it to him. So some of it is as much as just like a flake of paint or a fuse, and then some of it is a hubcap or a seatbelt and things that way. But yeah, we have these shadow boxes that have a piece of all of the planes that have been used in Air Force One, and there's a key on the back that says what the part is and what plane it was.
Yeah, it was a beautiful piece of it. It was such a cool perspective on history. Yeah. So you're running your business. David is the commander of Air Force One, and then he's diagnosed with cancer. And just, could you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so the analogy I use a lot is we lived in this kind of perfect world. It was like a perfect snow globe. Everything was idyllic and beautiful. And that one Saturday morning, somebody picked up that snow globe and shook it. And our whole world was turned upside down. And all of the pieces were still there, but nothing was in the same place. So David had gone and picked up our oldest daughter from the church. She found the YouTube lock-in. They went to Starbucks, got home. He was standing there and walked over to me, standing at the kitchen sink. And he said, look at my ankle. It was twitching. It was really weird.
And just as he said that, I watched what looked like a tidal wave roll up his body. And it was all of the muscles contracting. And it was literally a wave. And when it hit his chest, he grabbed his chest and said, "I can't breathe." And he collapsed on me. Now, mind you, he was 6'3", 200 pounds.
Yeah.
I lowered him to the ground the best I could and then watched him have a grand mal seizure while my two children were right there witnessing it. At that time, they were 10 and 12. My oldest daughter was very composed. She went, she grabbed the phone, she called 911, handed it to me, and then she ran across the street to get a very good friend of mine who was a nurse. Unfortunately, she wasn't home. So she flagged down the first neighbor she saw and they came in and helped me. They took him to our local hospital. They did a CT. They walked into the room and said he has a 4-centimeter mass in his front left lobe and medevac would be here in 12 minutes. And they helicoptered him up to Walter Reed. 2 days later, he had 9 hours of brain surgery where he only had 14 months to live. So that's that. Like I said, everything was still there. It just... nothing landing back in place. And obviously devastating our world.
And David passed, was it 24 months later?
28 months. He passed in November of 16.
I can't imagine, and what you had to do, I can't imagine that experience, and no one can. What you had to do, or you chose to do next, I think is extraordinary. You decided to reinvigorate the business and take it to a new level. And I really what I wanted to do is just explore that with you, Allie, because I think what you've done, particularly when people understand the circumstances, is extraordinary. After your spouse passes and you've lost that perfect snow globe, or I mean, it's been shaken up at least, how do you start a business again?
So at the time he was diagnosed, I brought my business back home. I'd been out in commercial space. I brought it back home and I had two phenomenal employees that helped me just maintain a client base. I didn't market. I didn't try to grow the business. I didn't try to do anything. After Dave passed, I took about 6 months to really decide what I wanted to do and think about it. And the silver lining in this is that it gave me the opportunity to rethink my business and reemerge better, reemerge stronger. Reemerge with a story, with a purpose. Before, you know, you hear all the time, you read the books, and what is your why? And why are you doing this? And what's your niche? Who are your best customers? And things that way. And at the time he got sick, I was just growing a business. I didn't really have a why. I'd fallen into based on economy and all of that. Now I had a purpose. I had a community who had supported me through his death that I wanted to be able to give back to. So I wanted a portion of the business to be fundraising for local businesses, nonprofits, things that way. And it gave us a purpose. So the silver lining is I got to reemerge stronger and with a true sense of purpose. And so we did. We moved back out. I took those two employees. We moved back out and went into a literally 1,200 square foot office space and started building the business. And we outgrew that space in 6 months. So we moved to the location that we got to come and tour and see. And now I actually have somebody coming in tomorrow to look at the space to figure out how we can reconfigure it because we're out of space again.
As you were caring for your husband, how do you still maintain that business? I mean, even though you came home and there's people supporting you, the business sustained and grew. Like, how do you do that in your mind? I can't comprehend.
I needed something to make me get out of bed every day.
Okay.
And I have a strong sense of, I'm very deadline driven. I have a very strong sense of meeting my commitments and fulfilling that obligation. So I won't, I guess I won't sugarcoat it. So I had lots of help with Dave. I needed to be able to use the business to step away for a couple hours every day. As much as I loved him and cared for him, that was a very daunting task. And if you can imagine the level of intelligence and leadership it takes to be the commander of Air Force One, that unit has over 400 people that fly or maintain the jet. And he led all of them. He died from primary brain cancer, glioblastoma, and that is a very evil cancer. It's a death sentence cancer. he was diagnosed at grade four. Nobody survives more than 5 years with a grade four. And so from the minute of diagnosis, we knew he was terminal. And my point to that was very taxing. And to slowly watch him lose his ability to speak, lose his ability to comprehend, lose his ability to walk and be mobile. Truthfully, the business was my salvation. It gave me a minute to step away every day while somebody else took care of him, which is not the nice thing to say. It's not the pretty thing to say. Because as much as I love for him, I had to step away. And having a business as an excuse to do that was convenient.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I'm hearing is the consequence on the caregiver, the emotional drain on you. Because I love how the business was an outlet for you. I presume David also recognized that you needed that. Was he supportive of that? What was his vantage point?
Yeah, absolutely. And truthfully, so in May of 14, when he had a seizure and he was diagnosed, he had the surgery and he went into a period of 15 months of remission. And so from then until August of 15, my caregiving was driving him because he couldn't drive, driving him to meetings, and getting him to and from work and things that way. But I'd take him to work and then I'd come home, I'd do the work. It wasn't a problem. Mm-hmm. In August of 15 is when he had reoccurrence. And from August 15 to November of 16, it was just a slow downhill slide. He had three more brain surgeries, one in September of 15, one in November of 15, and one in June of 16, all to try to slow the progression and things that way. And there's this anticipatory grief, which is a whole nother subject that we could get into, but the inevitable is coming. We had the initial trauma, but yeah. The inevitable is coming. We don't know when. Yeah. You can't plan for it. You just know it's coming. And even at that, he entered hospice on August 23rd. And I know that because they wanted to see us on the 22nd. And I said, you can't see us on the 22nd. It's his birthday. Unless you're going to give me good news. And they said, well, we'll see you on the 23rd. You know, so there was even that anticipation of, okay, you know, this isn't good. So he went into hospice in August. He still, because he was so young and so healthy, he lived until November. But there's that constant every day. Do I even go downstairs to the basement? Is he going to pass while I'm in the basement, working? You know, I couldn't imagine having the grief of me not being there with him when he passed. And yet that's a very real thing for a lot of people because there's a strong sense for individuals who are sick that they don't want to pass in front of their loved ones because they feel it's a burden. And so they'll wait, literally mind over matter, they'll wait through. Like we go to take a shower, you know.
Yeah.
And so there is all this anticipation of the what ifs and how's this is going to play out. Do I send my girls to school today or do I keep them home? Should I have a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old in the room when their father dies? Do they want to be there? Or do they not want to be there? And I asked them. And they both said they wanted to be there. But as a parent, you told them to, even if they want to be there, is that the best thing for them? You know, there's so much that goes through your mind and so many questions and doubts. And I look back at it now. Business really was a salvation. I'm sorry, I've got off on a little bit of a tangent. But the business really was a salvation for me to have a little bit of that respite. But with everything I did running the business and caring for people ask me, how did you know? Do you have any regrets thinking that way? And people that I help now who are going through a similar journey, I say you can only make a decision based on the information you have with what's in your heart. So I look back and think, maybe we could have done things differently. Sure, but I didn't have that information at that time. I've gotten new information since then. So I sleep well at night knowing I made the best decisions I could for my family in the moment with the information I had. And I believe Dave knew that as well.
And you decide to step up your game in the business afterwards. I presume, and this is presumptuous, it wasn't like there was a day, but all of a sudden, like, okay, I'm back in on this entrepreneurial game. How do you transition back into full-time entrepreneurship?
Yep. So first of all, I had to decide if I was going to stay in business, owning my own business, because I have a background as a criminologist. That was my background before I married Dave. And
that's
did I want to,
right?
Do I want to go chase serial killers or do I want to?
Did you figure out who stole your Camus wine? Oh, it was me.
Oh, yes. Yes. But there's been rehabilitation and retribution.
There's been retribution. Yeah. It cost me two bottles.
You stole one. I got two in return. It's okay.
So
I just really had to decide. And like a lot of entrepreneurs, there's that, well, yeah, I think I want to go at my own. I want to set my own schedule. I don't want to work, you know, crazy hours. Oh, wait, I work crazy hours, but, you know, okay. Yeah. You know, but at least that initial pretty view. And I decided I still needed to be there for my girls. I didn't want somebody else dictating my schedule. I didn't want people telling me whether I could take vacation or not. I wanted to just be able to do it on my own. And even though it's a risk, being an entrepreneur, I could take that risk and do that for myself. So there was a long process of deciding what I needed to do for myself and my girls and what the best fit was for me. And ultimately it was reemerging with my business. That was a pretty quick decision within probably 4 to 6 weeks of his passing. And then it was the planning, finding commercial space. We're just outside of DC. Space is expensive. Finding the right size. Can we grow? Can we move? How long of a lease? You know, all of that kind of stuff. So the next 4-5 months was laying the groundwork of where's the physical location going to be? What's available? What makes sense? What's a stretch for the budget? But what, you know, gives us some growth but doesn't bury us? It was just all the logistics.
Clients. Mm-hmm. This was really an expansion of the business. So you had active clients, so you knew you had some predictable revenue, but you were really, did you have a vision saying, I'm going to up-level this by 5 times? Like, how did you know how much space you would need?
No, I wish I was smart enough to make really calculated decisions. At that time, it was really a what is available, what keeps me close to home for my girls, not a long commute, and what can I afford? And those were the driving factors, which is why within 6 months we outgrew it, which was one, we had growth that was unpredictable, much, much more than we anticipated. But two, I went conservative. But fortunately, I'd signed a 1-year lease, so I was able to move pretty quickly. Yeah,
smart. So, how do you soliciting new types of clients, attracting new business?
So we probably do all the same traditional things that most businesses do. We've got our email lists. We do some Facebook ads. We do social media. Yeah. But truthfully, our best asset in marketing is my people. Sending Kimberly out, talking to people. We do product samples. I'll grab, you know, if there's somebody we really want to go after, we'll grab their logo off the internet. We'll take the expense on of digitizing it and getting it print ready. And we'll create a product form and then we'll show up their door with it and hand it to them and say, we want your business. And this is an example of the quality of our work. And that has worked really well. There's also been for us a significant amount of organic growth. We started with one fire department about a year ago, and put an online store for them. That's our bread and butter, is online source, e-commerce source for individual businesses. And we started with them, and then you know the next firehouse down the road saw what they had and they wanted it. And the next one down the road saw what they had, and then recently a dad came to us and said, "Hey, my son's a new firefighter from Montgomery County. And I want to get him some stuff, but I need help with size." So Kimberly stayed on the phone with him and helped him and said, "Okay, pull up the store. Let's look at it. What products? Okay, here's what I have for size charts. What size do you send normally wear? All of this." I got it all squared away. And then at the end of it, he goes, "Oh, this is really awesome. And I'm an active firefighter in Baltimore City. We need this as well." So then we went to Baltimore City. Now we have all of DC. We just actually crossed over up into Pennsylvania. So
nice.
Yeah. So now the joke is I'm going to get one of those scratch off maps and we're just going to slowly scratch off the states as we gain them. And
that's actually a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, what I love about this model, and you talk about your bread and butter, is this store. So that's an innovative idea. Could you explain more detail? Like why does a firehouse have a store?
So we don't do their professional turnout gear. We don't do the gear that they do the firefighting in. We do all of what we just call spirit wear. So any organization takes pride in where they work and what they do, or maybe it's a school or a sports team. And particularly right now with COVID, everybody wants to belong. They need the social. They're searching for social. So fire departments are no different. They're maybe a little bit like fraternities. It's a tight-knit group. They live together. They work hard together. You know, they're on shift for 24, 48 hours at a time. So it's an intimate group. And so capitalizing on that and doing so-called spirit wear or house gear, but in the traditional items that they wear, they have specific job shirts and jackets that are traditional to a firehouse that we got very educated on. And providing that for them so that they can wear it and show pride in their particular firehouse. It's just something that we've capitalized on and marketed. The belonging to that tribe.
I love that. I love it. It's such a unique model. So, you know, I was so impressed by what we're doing ourselves and what you can do. I haven't seen other promotional companies do is, if I have someone says, oh, I want one of your shirts. So we have these, you got this t-shirts yep. we made. You're like, oh, I want that. Say, okay, go to the site, buy the shirt for $20 or $30, whatever it is. Your company, Wear Your Spirit Warehouse will print it, package it, ship it, do the customer service behind it. It's all included. And now overnight I can have a store sharing wearables. When it comes to these firehouses, it's the dad of the new firefighter, or it's the firefighter herself or whatever, who's buying these items and supplying. So it doesn't cost the firehouse anything. They just make the designs available, right? And there's a uniform consistency.
Exactly. And that's our niche right there is, you know, with everything that's happened to me in life, you know, I talked about having a story. So one of our mottos are, life is hard. T-shirts shouldn't be. It should not be hard to pick out, design, and get a t-shirt. That should be something you can do easily. And so with businesses, corporations, schools, sports teams, that's where we come in. Let me be the expert. Let me be the expert in design. Let me be the expert in fulfillment and production. And just do it for you. You want to focus on writing books. You don't want to focus on designing and fulfilling merchandise. Right. You know, that's not your niche. That's my niche. So right. That's where we come in. And we do that too with uniforms for a lot of resorts. I'm kind of in a touristy area. So we do that uniforms for resorts and businesses where, you know, let's say a restaurant. Let's take a restaurant, for example. You know, do you really want your storage area where you could, where inches matter and you could be stocking the greatest ingredients to put on your menu, filled with t-shirts and uniforms, because you've got to have all these different sizes for when you right. hire somebody new. And then, oh, you run out of small. So now you need to place another order. But you don't want to just order 12. That's expensive. So, you know, but all you really need is small. So now you order. Now you got way too many 2XLs and not enough mediums. So we put up stores. The business tells us what uniform pieces they want on there. New hire goes there, puts in a code, that so they can get their uniform without it costing them anything. We fulfill it. We build the restaurant and send us a check. It's great. Easy. It's no inventory. No stress.
No inventory. Yeah, it's fantastic. In the book industry, we have print on demand. So mm-hmm. not necessarily my books, but you can buy books on Amazon. When you push on click, it gets printed basically behind the scenes yeah. and shipped to you.
That's exactly. What
you're doing these products, you're putting decorations on, it's print on demand. It's a massive savings. Because I've had the experience too, where I buy like, you know, 300 mugs because I need them. And now I'm sitting on 200 mugs. I just sit there for years. And at a certain point, I go, okay, I got to dump these now. And there's less waste. It's more efficient. It's such a good model. Why isn't everyone copying this? Is it because it's so difficult to execute on? My assumption.
Well, first of all, you have to have customers that see the value and the service, and you have to be able to explain the value and service because it is more expensive. If I'm not printing 500 t-shirts at once, I have to charge you more to print t-shirts one at a time. But you recognize that value, just like you identify.
Right.
I have to be really good at explaining that value,
yeah,
so that you see it as well. So that's one. Two, there is much more in the process to manage. So now we have a store up, and maybe they have 10 colors of t-shirts. Well, when I put that on press, I can't print black ink on a black t-shirt, and I can't print white ink on a white t-shirt, because you'll never see it. And so now you're managing ink changes and color changes and things that way. Also with our industry, there is a printer called a direct to garment printer. The technology behind it is really just starting to come into its own. Up till now, the print quality hasn't been as great. It fades faster. You don't get as much wash and wear out of it, and things that way. It's starting to get there. And so it is becoming more popular to print on demand using what's called a DTG printer. We also, because of the number of processes we have in-house, depending on the volume, we've been doing this now long enough that I have a pretty good sense of the volume your store will do when you come to me. And based on that, I can direct you to a process that fits that volume.
Yeah, yeah.
If you are a big organization, let's say a fire department, I know you're going to do a high volume. It makes sense for me to set up traditional silk screen and put it on press. If you are a smaller organization with 30 employees, I'm going to recommend that we do something embroidery, because I can do small runs of embroidery, or sublimation. Yes, that's a different product line that we're going to look at, but it's all wearable. It's all branding, and it's marketing your business still. But that's where we come in with that expertise. And there's a lot of businesses, they're good at what they do. They don't want to get into the nitty gritty, and they don't want to do that level of customer service necessarily, which is great.
It's a reinvention of the entire business. I dare say you're doing Six Sigma compliance too, right?
I am. Yeah. I am in the process of becoming black belt certified.
Yeah.
We dive.
What I realized the day I visited your facility is there's a great difference between the promotional company and someone that does design on demand work like your company does. It is a manufacturing process. You're doing Six Sigma compliance, lean research. You had one shelving system, and I'm not going to share your secret sauce, right next to the sublimation system. I was like, holy cow, this is so smart on how you're sorting orders. And you could see the speed that you can turn things out and maintain the highest degree of quality. Really impressed. Why don't we look at the future? You know better than anyone, the future is not predictable. Do you have intentions and plans? Like, what's it look like 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, without revealing my true age, let's say 12 years from now, I'd like to retire. So my business is purposely now growing the business and then positioning it very well to be able to sell and retire. But that's a long ways off yet. My youngest is still in high school. I'm not going to up and retire the minute she retires from, or she graduates from high school or anything that way. But I stayed in Maryland because of the age of my children when their father died, mm-hmm, and wanting to provide them stability. I have no family here. I have phenomenal friends, but my closest relatives are in Florida, Wisconsin, and Washington State.
Pick Florida, maybe Washington.
Pick Florida,
Wisconsin's a little chilly.
Dave took me there in February one time. I said, we're never retiring here.
Okay,
it's,
okay.
It's beautiful, but it's cold. And I get long-winded. I apologize. But so business-wise, I look forward twofold. You can have a very successful business that nobody wants to buy. They might want to buy your equipment, but particularly in our industry, my customer could be the same customer as the guy 2 miles up the road and the guy 3 miles down the road. So nobody's buying a book of business they'll just want to buy the equipment. There isn't value in that book of business unless I've built it where we are the experts and we are the only business they're coming to, which is our goal with fire, police, military, first responders, is to build that our brand to where there really is no other choice.
Yeah.
And then be able to eventually sell and retire.
Own the niche, be the authority.
Own the niche.
Yep. Yeah. I love that you're doing that. What do your daughters think of you?
They think I'm crazy. No.
First of all, you must think you're super mom. I mean, gosh, the way you stepped up.
There is a sense of pride. My oldest daughter will tell all of her friends. She'll get them to make designs that she's like, "Hey, mom, can you print this? You know, for my
of course.
My college dorm." I'm like, "Well, first of all, let's make sure we're not breaking any copyright laws. This is college, you know." Yeah. And things that way. But so there is absolutely a sense of pride. I think it will come more and more in time as they get older and they have kids of their own and they realize what that juggle is. You know, they're teenagers right now. They know more than me. They're smarter than I am.
Yes.
You know, all of that. But the older they get, the more I think they appreciate it. And I think someday when they're married and they realize what the loss of a spouse could truly mean, I hope they never experience, but what it could truly mean, I think there'll be a little bit greater appreciation.
Yeah. Ali Banholzer, you're one of the remarkable entrepreneurs navigating the personal challenges that I think most people can never, ever even fathom. You've done it and you've built a successful business. It's remarkable. Thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I enjoy it. I love telling our stories.
I love your success. Just keep it going. Keep it going.
Absolutely. Well, and you are a key part of that because I will tell you, Profit First made a huge difference in my business going to that. I mean, huge difference. And then, you know, being in your mastermind group and things that way and being able to meet like-minded entrepreneurs that you've kind of hand-selected has made a major difference.
Oh, I love our group. I love being.
Yes.
Thanks again.
Absolutely. Yep. Thank you.
Okay. So that was Allison Banholzer, the CEO of WearSpiritWarehouse.com. I want everyone listening in right now, go to that website. It's a super cool. WearYourSpiritWarehouse.com. I'll start out, Jeremy. I thought there was two powerful things. The obvious thing was the passing of her husband. It is tragic. And how the business actually became a form of therapy. At least that's what I heard. But to me, the other element that was surprising was the reinvention of the business. That she's doing this print on demand of items for firehouses, but other businesses too. I thought that was a really cool model. I haven't seen it before. Maybe it does exist. I haven't seen it before in this industry of promotional items.
Yeah.
What did you learn?
I mean, it was really interesting. It reminded me, the whole story about her husband reminded me when I worked in restaurants, because it's one of those industries that, you know, it's glamorized on TV, but it's a really tough thing. I mean, you're working when nobody else is working, you're putting in crazy long hours. And so there would be days where I would be, you know, something personal in my personal life would be wrong. And so then I would just dive into work even more. And then I would lose myself in, you know, whether it was a recipe or the prep for the day or something. And that was what got me through those hard times, was to just focus on that 120%. And I think it's, you know, really interesting how that's what she did. But then on top of it, she innovated like a level up in the industry. So it's just unreal.
I think it's the way you applied that. It's just a healthy outlet. I think we have the choice when we're overwhelmed or feeling depressed, or experiencing something as tragic as Al experienced, that the outlets can be a mix. You can be idle, which just buries you in the thought. That's dangerous. You could apply it to something productive, cooking, exercising, working, or you could do it with something destructive, right? Like overeating, drinking, something like that. I do know this, though. Anything, though, to an extreme can become dangerous. And you know, the one thing, and I didn't hear it happen to her, but I wonder if it was her daughters. She could have buried herself so much in, I love that mug.
Oh, that mug? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. little gift for the week.
Little gift. What's interesting is she didn't take it to an extreme with work. That's what I was anticipating. Was now she becomes a workaholic because now that's a way to give herself relief. I think her daughter is actually trade that balance. She had responsibilities back home, so she couldn't just bury herself and get lost in it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unreal. I mean, I think it's really inspirational when you see somebody go through such a dark period and still remain positive and reinvent themselves and come out in a better position than she was before.
something she said that didn't play out in the interview. This was something she just mentioned offline. It was about 3.5 years after David passed. And she told myself, and actually the rest of the group, she's like, today I feel on myself again. And so not that, you know, the grieving process never ends, but it does morph, it does change. And there was this, she was the wife of a deceased commander of Air Force One for 3.5 years. Now she's Ali Banholzer, who in her story, she was married to the commander of Air Force One, but she became herself again. And I thought that was just a miraculous transition. I don't think any of us can anticipate how long the grieving process is going to go. But she navigated in a way, I think, that was just inspirational. So yeah, and we'd love to hear you, our dear listeners, what your thoughts are. That was a, you know, a tough conversation. Maybe you've experienced something similar, something that really put you in a spiral. And how did you leverage your business? Were you able to? Were you not? Post that in the comments. We really appreciate the reviews. So go right now, if you're willing, please post us a review, honest review, whatever you feel we deserve. And make sure you subscribe. We don't want you to miss a single episode of Mike Up in Your Business. And who knows, maybe I'll get up in your business. All right, J-Bone, it's kind of weird. It's just me and you. Do you have a game or
show? I do. I do a quiz for you.
Okay, it's a quiz for Mike.
Yeah. One thing I just wanted to add that I made in my notes that Allie said, because I think people beat themselves up in hindsight, because hindsight's always 20/20. She said, I did the best I could with the info I had at the time. And right? I think that people, when they look back and they regret or they beat themselves up, they just need to think, hey, you know, at the time you didn't have all the information. You did what you could.
Yeah.
I love that. I thought that was
a great, great line she shared.
Cool. So, her husband, was involved with Air Force One.
Yeah.
So we got some Air Force One trivia.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. This was really interesting. This was cool. But so just as a side note, do you think Air Force One is just one plane? Because it's not.
I did know that. I think it's minimally two operational planes.
It's two operational planes, I think, at minimum. But Air Force One is just the call sign for the one that has the president. I thought it was the name for the actual plane. But yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
That was cool.
That's interesting.
Okay, so question one is, when it's fully fueled, how far can Air Force One travel? And this is the modern Air miles. Force One, which is like, the, yeah, 5 miles. All five right, miles, so all right, sir. I know we just took off, but we're landing.
You just run down the runway and you're done.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to drive the rest.
I forget what the, it's a Boeing, I want like the SM9000 or something. I can't remember the model number. But anyway, so is it 2,000 miles, 4,000 miles, or 6,000 miles? And keep in mind, I think the California to East Coast is like 2,500 miles as the crow flies or something like that.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. You know what? That's what I was basing it on. And I was thinking that was 5,000 miles from coast to coast. But I think you're right. I think it's a round trip that's 25.
Yeah, I think. No. I think one way is 20. Yeah, that's one way is 25. Yeah, yeah.
I thought one way was 5,000, but I think you're right.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So, yeah. So 2,000, 4,000, or 6,000.
Okay.
All right, question two. What is the name of the Cadillac that flies ahead of Air Force One in order to drive the president once he lands? Is it called Cadillac One, Charlie Bravo, or CODIS? Not coitus.
The Cadillac of the president. Okay. Okay.
All right. The first president to fly on Air Force One was
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? One day these will be popular.
That would be awesome. Was it Herbert Hoover, FDR, or Harry Truman?
Okay. That's
a tough one.
Yeah. I'm ready. I hope our listeners too are jacked over this one. I'm going to say something really, really gutsy for the first one, the distance they can travel.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to say 6,000 miles.
It's actually over 6,000 miles.
Really?
Yeah. I guess they designed it so it's about the distance from flying from DC to Tokyo, Japan in one trip.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, because that plane does some long trips.
Yeah.
I
And I've been on a flight from the US to Australia. I don't think I've ever gone from New York to Australia. I've gone from LA to Sydney. So I know planes can do those extraordinary, and I assume that's over 6,000. I think it's 9,000 miles.
How long a trip was that to Australia?
Oh my God, like a lifetime. I know it was, I want to say cumulative flying time was 16 or 17 hours. Oh my God. You know, you fly from New Jersey to LA, that's a 6 hour, 5.5 hour to 6 hour flight. Then you hop on and you got another 12 or 13.
That's brutal.
And that's just monstrous. Dude, you're up there. You're like, okay, I saw 6 movies in a row. I cannot do anymore. Oh,
it's yeah. I remember the longest flight that I ever took was flying back and forth to Switzerland.
Yeah.
It was about 12 hours. And
was it really?
Yeah.
From the East Coast?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I have long legs. And so I would constantly be getting up and standing and stretching. And there's only so much stretching you can do. And to so much like nodding off until you wake up and you look at your watch and you're like, oh my God, we still have 5 more hours.
Yeah, what? Yeah, yeah. It's murderous. Murderous.
What is going on right now? Yeah.
The worst flight I ever did was, I'll tell you the two worst flights. One was flying to Australia and back. I was in Australia for 3 days. It was just a quick gig down there and I had to get back for another gig. Oh my God. It was, you know, that was murderous. The worst flight though I ever was on was to Buffalo from New Jersey. I'm flying and all of a sudden the plane starts a dive, like just a straight down dive. Your stomach's in your throat. And you know, people are reading their newspaper and all of a sudden it just starts diving. Well, this one woman shrieks. She goes, "Aah!" I was the woman. It was me shrieking. No one else even moves. Like everyone else is just kind of flipping their paper. All of a sudden we level off and the pilot's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, we had to do that. We started losing cabin pressure, so we dove to get repressurized." And no one even flinched. Dude, my heart's racing. I'm like, we're dying. That was the worst flight
That's
ever.
That's crazy. It's yeah. Funny. There's this comedian, and he does his bit on Australia, and he's like talking about how long the flight is. He's like, "Yeah, you know, it's okay. But like the flight is it sucks. It's awful." He said, "So when I get there, I want to see a kangaroo in the airport." He's like, "I just took this long flight. I want a kangaroo in the airport because that is ridiculous. Like there needs to be something in the airport to make you excited that you just went through that hell to get there."
I like that. Yeah. I like that.
Okay.
Question. Right, so next question.
Question 2.
Yeah. So the Cadillac, I would say it's Charlie Bravo. I can't imagine them using a name like Cadillac in the, they don't call it the Boeing 1. So I say Charlie Bravo.
It's actually Cadillac 1.
Is it really?
Yeah. Or the Beast was the other nickname that they
Beast.
Called
I like the Beast. Beast better.
Yeah. So what's crazy is they actually fly a separate plane with the car ahead of Air Force 1 to land to get the car out to have it ready.
Oh my God. Well, that car must be just pure bulletproof, yeah. Explosion proof.
Tax money at work right there.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, and then the first president to fly on Air Force One.
I say Truman. I don't think it is, though.
It was FDR. Yeah. So close, in 1943.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that was right during, that's during World War II, I believe, right?
Yeah, during World War II, yeah. And they said that it was a really scary flight because they were scared about the German U-boats and the you know, over the sea trying to you know take
missiles
the plane
up.
Down. Yeah.
My gosh. All right, my friends. Well, there you have it. Hope you did okay on those questions and hope you enjoyed the interview with Ali Banholzer. Oh, there's Jeremy's cat. look at that guy.
He just walks all over the keyboard and the computer. He doesn't care. It's so
crazy. I love when a cat's picked up and just holds his arm straight out. you are dear listening friends. I hope you enjoyed the show. Just a reminder, make sure you subscribe right now, if you haven't subscribed so you don't miss a single episode, please do give us a rating and review. Visit MikeMikalowicz.com or MikeMotorbike.com to get insights we have going on. And here's the big one. Right now, you're listening on your phone. It's right in front of you. You can just type this in. Ask Mike at MikeMikalowicz.com. You can do that. Just type in ask Mike at MikeMikalowicz.com and then say you know, in the subject line, here's my question and put in any question you have around your business. We want to explore for you. With you. So do that right now. All right. That's it. Have a great day.